right, welcome back. You're listening to Arab Talk on KPOO 89.5 FM.
And on today's show, we're very honored and lucky to have Mr. Hisham Melhem, who is the Washington-based correspondent for Anahar, the leading Lebanese daily, Al-Qabas, the Kuwaiti daily, Radio Monte Carlo in France, and he's currently the host of Across the Ocean, a weekly talk show for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite station. Mr. Melhem, welcome to Arab Talk in San Francisco.
Thank you.
Listen, we thought it would be very instructive for our listeners for you to give us kind of a tour de force right now in terms of the larger picture of what's happening in the Arab world right now, and kind of ground our listeners in the context. There's so much going on right now. We wondered if you could just give us an overview.
Well, conditions are not stellar in the Arab region, in the Arab world, whether we have the challenge of Darfur, where the Arab League unfortunately has failed to deal with this issue before Western intervention, UN intervention, American intervention, which is warranted in my view. You have Iraq still teetering on the verge of civil war. There's still a debate going on whether we are in a civil war or on the verge of civil war, or what the conditions in Iraq should be called, low-intensity civil strife. And then you have the continuing uncertainty in key states such as Algeria, which has yet to recover from painful internal convulsion. And you have also the recent political tension in the Egyptian society. Throughout the region, in those societies where you have different ethnic and religious strata and groups, there is tension. We're seeing it now in terms of the growing sense of Muslim identity in the region, which also leads sometimes to sectarian identity. We are seeing that in a very salient and painful way in Iraq, Shia versus Sunni, in Egypt, Sunni versus Copts, in Lebanon, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, between the Sunnis and the Shia. There is, on the whole, a very unhealthy situation, with the exception probably of some cities in the Gulf. But conditions in the Arab world, unfortunately, are not very encouraging. And whatever indices we use to judge the progress of any society, we see failure, whether we're talking about life expectancy, level of education, per capita income, scientific creativity, all of that. There is unfortunately a deficiency in the Arab world.
Yeah, Hisham, I want to go back or get an update on today's event. I was watching television this morning, and all of a sudden on Jordan TV, and of course this was carried on other networks, we have a confession by a Hamas member that Hamas has been smuggling arms via Syria into Jordan, and something appeared funny about this and the timing of it. I mean, do you have any information on the timing of this event?
I didn't see the report that you're referring to, but I, of course, we've heard before that these Jordanian allegations against Hamas, which were used by the Jordanian government to justify or to explain their decision not to meet Hamas representatives in Amman. I have no way of corroborating these charges. I mean, these are at this stage still allegations. If they were true, I would think that this would be tremendously reckless on the part of those people who are doing it. If that's the case, if anybody from Hamas is involved, I find it difficult to believe, but I really have no way of lending any credence to these allegations.
Yeah, but this also leads me to the issue of Hamas in general and how it has been viewed around the world and in the Middle East. And the concept of democracy, because we have, the U.S. Preaching democracy and encouraging pluralism and elections in the Arab world, and yet the Palestinians went out to the polls, whether they've done the right thing or not, or, you know, elected Hamas or not. That's not the issue. But what happened now is we are seeing a campaign to choke the Palestinians internally and externally. How this has been playing in the Arab media?
Obviously, many. I mean, the prevailing view, if you will, in the Arab media, and I don't like to generalize about the Arab media, obviously, for obvious reasons, but is that the West and the United States, in particular, are trying to quote unquote punish the Palestinian people for their democratic choice when they picked Hamas as when they gave Hamas a majority during the last elections. Things are obviously more complex than that. I think many Europeans, and let me put the United States now on the side for a second, many Europeans will be, if not most Europeans, will be willing to deal with Hamas if Hamas accepts the previous commitments or obligations that both the Palestinian Authority and Israel have agreed upon, although all of us know that the Israelis did not keep their end of the bargain, and many of them. But in the United States, it's a bit complex. I think the United States, until this moment, will, if you talk to American officials, they will tell you we still believe that we should push for greater democratization, reform, accountability, empowerment throughout the Middle East, or what they call now the Greater Middle East and region. And and of course, they would say that the elections were fair and there was no coercion involved. But at the same time, they say it's not the question of the choice. It's a question that the party that now leading the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, that is, still refuses to recognize Israel, recognize the resolutions that led to the evolution or the emergence of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and the laws that allowed the recent elections. So at least their argument is that we won't deal with Hamas officially until it accepts these conditions that were laid out by the quartet following the Palestinian elections. And this is reminiscent of the conditions that the United States and Israel and the Europeans, but mostly the Americans and the Israelis, the conditions that they put on the PLO before, in the late 1980s, before the dialogue, quote-unquote, between the United States and the PLO. I think many people now, including the Palestinian Authority, I mean the Hamas, the United States, Israel, the Arab states, and everybody else, is in many ways, or all of them, somewhat are responsible for the current plight of the Palestinian people. And if you want to be honest about this, there is a dearth of creative thinking on the part of Hamas, definitely on the part of the Israelis and the United States and the Arab states and the European, as to what how to deal with this situation in a way that would not punish the Palestinian people.
What do you think that would look like? If you say there's a dearth of thinking about that, What would you think would be some possible ideas of how to think through and approach that at this time?
I think there may be a sliver of hope in this recent agreement by the quartet in New York that a mechanism of some sort could be developed to prevent starvation, to prevent deprivation in the Palestinian in Palestine, without quote unquote rewarding Hamas. I mean, I can understand that legally in the United States. Let's assume, for the sake of discussion, that the United States, that the Bush administration would like to deal with Hamas. By law, it cannot do that because of the Congress, because of the United States did classify Hamas as a terrorist organization. So legally, they cannot deal with Hamas. Legally, the American banking system cannot deal with an authority with Hamas or allow American banks or European banks, for that matter, to transfer money to Hamas and deal at the same time with the American banking system. So, I mean, put the issue of intentions aside. It's going to be extremely difficult. What I'm saying is, along with many people like Jimmy Carter and others who are saying, let's have some sort of a creative thinking here and not try not to deprive the Palestinian people of their basic needs. At the same time, it is appalling, to put it mildly, that the Palestinian people now, as Yasser Abdrabbu said yesterday here in Washington, appear to be like international beggars, and that should not be the case. The Arab state should intervene. The Europeans, I think there is a great deal of thinking in Europe as to what is the best way to prevent a bad situation from becoming tragic in the Palestinian territories. All I'm saying is that sometimes I don't think that there is a similar thinking here in Washington. It's as if blaming Hamas only will solve the problem or will absolve us from moral responsibility and even political responsibility. And even if you don't want to buy the moral responsibility, if you allow the situation to fester in the West Bank and Gaza, and that void will be exploited by parties and states that the United States don't want want them to have an opening, i.e. Iran, other groups in the region like Hezbollah and others.
But this is
so
the
politically, it's very wise not to allow the situation to deteriorate further. And I think morally, the argument is very clear.
Except, however, this particular policy has failed the United States not only in Palestine but in Iraq, and it seems like it's an ongoing series of blunders because at this point, Hisham, the Palestinians are being offered the following choices: either submit to a brutal occupation or starve to death. And how are Palestinians supposed to accept that kind of choice?
Look, I mean, you and I can criticize the United States foreign policy in the Middle East, and I don't pull punches in this regard, whether in Iraq or in Palestine, or even the Europeans. But there is also an Arab responsibility. There is also a Hamas responsibility. You just cannot tell me that these people were elected and now and they have no vision. They have no economic policy. They have no. They have no political approach. They haven't thought through as to how they govern, how they're going to get money. I mean, we're asking these questions, these serious questions in terms of governance, real issues. Okay, they would say, you know, God will provide, or the Muslim states will provide. Well, I mean, come on, give me a break. Whether you like it or not, the United States and the European Union are the biggest donors to the Palestinian Authority, not the Arab states, not the Muslim states. And every time history tells you that when people make pledges, whether you know, talk about donor countries or whatever, whether it's for the Palestinians or Lebanese and others, sometimes 60% of these pledges are not honored. So nobody is going to come up with that kind of money that will pay the salaries of the Palestinian employees. Those people are employed by the Palestinian Authority. We're talking about $160 million a month. And I'm not talking about the infrastructure, I'm not talking about other services. So also Hamas has a political responsibility and a moral responsibility. And I don't see them acting as if they are really cognizant of what the situation demands of them in terms of responsibility.
Yeah,
you know, to deliver to their own people too. I mean, it's very easy to criticize the United States and the West. But also there is a Palestinian responsibility. There is also an Arab responsibility.
That's right, Hisham. But, I mean, my argument to that is they weren't even given a minute, you know, to gather their breath and, you know, create a plan, economic plan and so forth. They were under attack from the minute they came into power. But I want to actually shift gears a little bit and go into Lebanon, and today and yesterday's big headline news were the thousands of people marching in the streets of Beirut, you know, complaining about the tax increase and the economy there at a time that there is still a lot of campaign or a lot of feud going on between, you know, Lebanon and Syria. Can you give us an update on this?
Well, as you well know, Lebanese-Syrian relationship deteriorated in a radical, painful fashion following the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and in fact, even before, with the assassination attempt against Marwan Ahmadi, the Lebanese deputy member of parliament. Many Lebanese, including those who probably were marching yesterday believe that the Syrians have been implicated in this crime, directly or indirectly. The findings so far, tentative, incomplete, albeit, by the United Nations investigators also point the finger at Syria and some of its allies in Lebanon, whether in the security services or among politicians. And obviously, Syrian behavior in Lebanon, particularly since the Taif Agreement in the last 15 years, 16, 17 years, has been really horrendous, and in many ways, Syria treated Lebanon as a fief, you know, as a fiefdom. Many Lebanese, including people like me, who always supported good, friendly, special relationship with Syria, found themselves in an impossible position to defend practices that are humiliating, to say the least, and predatory, to put it bluntly. But obviously, Syria, because of history, culture, economics, geography, has many friends, allies, or even agents, if you want to be blunt again, in Lebanon. And many of them still see their interest and their future linked to a special relationship with the Syrian regime, not necessarily with Syria itself. And Syria is still exercising a great deal of influence in Lebanon. And the Syrian regime is not acting yet, in my opinion, in a way that would lead me to believe that they do accept Lebanon as a sovereign neighbor, as the final homeland for its own various communities.
Do you think?
And that's why they still resist establishing normal diplomatic relations, because they don't want to deal with Lebanon via an embassy. They want to deal with Lebanon via the security services or their friends and allies and agents in Lebanon, which is no self-respecting Lebanese can accept that or should accept that.
Do you think, though, there are foreign powers interfering besides Syria in creating that rift? I mean, this has been, you know, coming out from perhaps Syria's position in other countries that, you know, Israel has something to do with it, the U.S. has something to do with it, or is it just a Syria-Lebanon issue?
Look, I mean, Lebanon had a civil strife, civil war, call it whatever you will. And usually every civil war that takes place, you find the neighbors somewhat involved in it, whether we talk about the Spanish Civil War, the Lebanese War, and Vietnam, you name it. The Israelis did involve themselves in Lebanon. They did invade Lebanon twice. They did lay a brutal siege to Beirut in 1982, and we all know the history. We all know the bloodshed and the massacres that followed. And unfortunately, some Lebanese did collaborate with the Israeli invaders. When Syria intervened in Lebanon in 1976, certain Lebanese groups welcomed Syria. In fact, every country that went to Lebanon sent troops to Lebanon, whether officially like the multinational forces, including the Americans and the French and the Italians, found many Lebanese supporting them. Even when the Iranians sent their Pasdaran and so-called Revolutionary Guards, they found a Lebanese group or groups welcoming them. Unfortunately, this has been the case. So it would be naive not to expect neighboring states, including Israel and Syria, not to mention Iran, which is not a country that has a common border with Lebanon, playing a role. I mean, those today who are lamenting the Syrian withdrawal, they don't want to talk about the Syrian hegemony in Lebanon. Now they are criticizing the Americans and the French. Look, I mean, had it not been for the demonstrations in the streets of Beirut, in March of last year, had it not been for the Americans and the French who pushed on the international scene and the United Nations, Syria would have stayed and remained in Lebanon through its military force. And so the American influence in Lebanon, the French influence in Lebanon, obviously does not sit well with Syria and its friends in Lebanon. But those friends of Syria and Lebanon look the other way when the Iranians act in Lebanon through their friends and allies, Hezbollah and others, send weapons to Lebanon, play an important role in Lebanon politically. The Iranian ambassador competes with the American ambassadors and others. So if you want to talk about foreign or regional influence in Lebanon, yeah, let's talk about it and say, yeah, the French and the Americans are supporting a certain course of action. Iran and Syria and others and Israel have other interests and options in supporting certain groups. If you do that, fine. I mean, in terms of, you know, as an analytical exercise, but one cannot compare. And I think Israel was defeated in Lebanon in 1982, in the year 2000, when it was forced by the Lebanese resistance, which was a legitimate, morally and legally, to resist the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. Israel was defeated in the year 2000. I think the Israeli influence, political influence in Lebanon, is very minimal, and I think people should not exaggerate that. I mean, analytically, one should not exaggerate it. Syria, on the other hand, is an Arab state, and we have a historic relationship and cultural commonalities and all that, but also Syria is exercising not an influence in Lebanon. It would like to resurrect its former hegemony in Lebanon. And there is a difference between influence and hegemony. And the Syrian intervention in Lebanon 76 was, you know, labeled by many Lebanese as an intervention. Later on, that intervention became an occupation. Now, it matters very little, to be honest with you, to be blunt.
Yes.
Whether the occupier speaks your language or speaks French or Farsi. I mean, you know, it's unacceptable in principle, especially if somebody claims that they are your brothers or they are your brethren, when they treat you like a fiefdom. And essentially, if we don't like George Bush's policies in Lebanon and Iraq, he will probably be, you know, 2 years from now, he will not be in the office.
Yes.
But the fellow who sits in Tehran or the other fellow who sits in Damascus, unfortunately, will stay for a long time.
That's the voice of Hisham Melhem. He's currently the host of Across the Ocean, a weekly talk show for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite station. Hisham, we want to thank you very much for being with us and giving us a very informative analysis of the Arab world, especially Lebanon. I'm sure we're going to have you back on Arab Talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We'd like to apologize to our listeners. We had a problem again whenever we call Gaza. And thanks, you know, I'd like to thank the Shabak, the Mossad, the CIA, the NSA, all those folks that are listening. Why we always have a problem when we call Gaza. But anyway, we have with us finally Diana Bhutto on the line. Diana, welcome to Arab Talk.
Thank you.
Diana, I know that the circumstances in Gaza right now are very, very bad, but I don't think people who are listening to the corporate media or watching the corporate media truly understand the gravity of the situation. Could you just give our listeners an idea of what's happening right now?
Certainly. I'll do my best. I think it's really important to understand what the Gaza Strip is like. It's an area that is 26 miles long, 12 miles wide at its widest point, has more than 1.3 million people living in it, and is considered the most densely populated place on Earth. The only way that there's no seaport into Gaza, there's no airport. There actually was an airport, but it was destroyed by the Israeli army. And the only place where goods can actually get through into Gaza is through one single crossing point called Karni. This crossing point has now been closed between 60 to 75% of the time since the start of this year, which means that basic necessities are simply not coming into the Gaza Strip. And what I mean by basic things, I'm talking about medicines, I'm talking about flour, I'm talking about petroleum. And so basic foodstuffs, basic necessities, basic medicines are not actually making it into the Gaza Strip on a regular basis. Similarly, things are not being exported on a regular basis because the same crossing point is closed or has been closed by the Israelis for a great amount of time. So businesses that once were able to operate are now not able to ship out goods. And so pretty much what we've seen is that the economy is almost at a standstill, coupled with the fact that there are no laborers who work inside Israel any longer. And given that the Palestinian Authority is completely cash-strapped, owing to the fact that Israel refuses to remit the customs revenues that it collects on behalf of the Palestinian Authority illegally, coupled with, as well as the fact that the international donor community is now refusing to assist the Palestinian Authority for the Palestinian people for electing Hamas, we're pretty much seeing that the economy has come to a virtual standstill. If you look at the decline just in the course of the past 5 months, it's the economy of the Gaza Strip has seen a 25% decline. Now, to a lot of people, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if you think of the Great Depression saw a 9% drop in the economy over the period of the depression. Whereas in Gaza alone, within 5 months, we've seen a 25% drop. So in terms of what life is like, it's very difficult to get basic foodstuffs, very difficult to get medicine. Hospitals are running dangerously low. Shops are running dangerously low. Today there was a protest by the gas stations, basically saying that there is no gas, there's no petroleum coming into the city. And so we're seeing an increasing level of poverty now that Palestinians haven't received their salaries for close to 3 months.
Now, I've seen, you know, reports that you have Palestinians. Yesterday they had a report actually on Abu Dhabi TV where they showed Palestinian women selling their jewelry to feed their children. And you know, the report when it started, it said, there is a brisk business in the jewelry business in Palestine. Initially you thought, oh, what's going on? But they actually, that has been the only commodity for many of these women to sell and in order to feed their children. Do you think the situation in Gaza is on the brink of starvation?
It's certainly on the brink of collapse. Yes, we are seeing a lot of women who are selling their gold, that being their only asset, and selling their gold in order to be able to get at least some money so that they can feed their children. Unfortunately, it's only a one-way sale, because the purchasers of the people who are they're selling the jewelry to can purchase it. But there isn't the other way around. It's not that you're seeing an actual exchange of gold. It's just a one-way exchange. And yes, it is on the brink of collapse. I mean, the United Nations Office of Coordinated Humanitarian Aid is reporting that the cutoff of financial aid to the Palestinian people and to the Palestinian Authority has had severe consequences. That even if there is an attempt to try to simply feed the Palestinians, that food agencies will not be able to meet the demand that is caused by this cutting off of salaries. And more importantly, the fact that Karni, this crossing point, remains closed for such a long period of time also means that people who were once relatively middle class or relatively well off are also being drastically affected. I mean, I can just tell you in my own personal life, I don't live in a refugee camp. I'm not suffering in the same way, but I can tell you that there are basic food items that I can now no longer get. And by basic, I'm talking about food and I'm talking about milk and bread, coupled with the lack of consistent medicine. So it's affecting all Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, not just a select number of Palestinians.
Deanna, isn't this constitute a form of collective punishment, and isn't that a grave breach of the Geneva Convention? Because it seems like on the surface that they're saying that this is directed towards the Hamas government, but every single Palestinian now is suffering and on the brink of starvation.
Absolutely, this is collective punishment. The Israelis know it. The international community knows it. The problem is not that they don't know it. The problem is that they're not willing to do anything about it. And so we laughingly hear that you know, in order for the situation to change, that Hamas has to recognize Israel, it has to recognize the signed agreements, and it has to renounce violence. And yet we've never heard Israel recognize Palestine. If we did, then we wouldn't be in this situation. Renounce violence and recognize signed agreements. In fact, Sharon was the person who, within the first few months of coming into office, said that the signed agreements were null and void. So it's quite laughable that everybody is sort of forcing Hamas into this position, and yet Israel has never taken any of the same positions that Hamas is being forced into. And coupled with that, nobody would ever dream of imposing such collective measures on Israel for the fact that it's violated international law for so many years, whereas these collective measures are seen as being routine, okay, and yes, it's all right to kick up a fuss about them, but we're not going to do a whole lot about them either.
Deanna, we have a few minutes left, but we also have to discuss something about what's going on the arena of the Hamas-Fatah rivalry. Also talk about the news that what was reported from Jordan about having caught some Hamas members smuggling weapons from Syria. And if there is a truth in this thing, you know, what would be the purpose of creating this rift between now Jordan, Hamas, and Syria, and who are the players and who are going to be the beneficiaries of this?
Right. Well, on the level of Fatah and Hamas, there is certainly a lot of rivalry, a lot of action taking place, negative, obviously, taking place in the Gaza Strip. But I think it's important to put it in its proper context. This is the first change of leadership that that the Arab world, or at least Palestine, has seen in 40 years. And it was remarkable, actually, just how smooth it went. And, of course, everybody was expecting chaos and expecting the worst, but it was just remarkable just how smooth a transition it was between a Hamas government and between a Fatah government and a Hamas government. There was no power struggle. Nobody tried to take over. None of the former ministers tried to retain their positions. Nobody denied the legitimacy of the elections, and instead, it was a rather very smooth transition on the executive level. The problem, however, is not on the executive level. The problem is on the street level, and on the street level. The reason that there is this rivalry, this factional breakdown happening, is for a few reasons, two of which I'll try to highlight. The first and foremost is that many of the security services no longer know what their goal is. Some of the security services were originally told that their goal was to make the Palestinian and Israeli streets safe by being forced to be the security subcontractor to Israel. Today, and what, of course, that meant was going after Hamas. It meant cracking down on Hamas for the sake of Oslo in order to implement the agreements. Today, with Hamas in power, they're not quite sure what it is that they're supposed to be doing. Are they really supposed to be protecting Israel? Is that really what the goal is, to be the security subcontractor? And so there's a situation where the old people who were once in these security forces don't necessarily know what it is that they're supposed to be doing, don't quite understand who it is they're supposed to be taking orders from, and don't quite understand what the purpose is any longer. And so it's very understandable why it is that there is this level of confusion and frustration, coupled with the fact that there was so much bad blood in the past. But I think the more important reason, or the reason that explains more of this, is the fact that people just haven't been paid their salaries for months and months on end. It's now been 2.5 months that that people haven't been paid their salaries. You've got security folks who were once members of Fatah who are not receiving their salaries, while at the same time there are rumors that people in Hamas, are receiving their salaries. And of course, this creates a great deal of resentment and is a recipe for chaos in the streets. And unfortunately, both factions are playing into the hands of Israel and playing into the chaos, allowing this chaos to proliferate. So it's not at all surprising. It's something that a lot of people predicted. I just wish that it wouldn't happen. On the issue of Jordan and the smuggling of weapons and all of that sort of stuff, I really don't have enough information to be able to make any real assessment on that point.
That's the voice of Diana Boutu, resident of Gaza right now, former legal advisor to the PLO and advisor to President Mahmoud Abbas. Diana, we wish you safety and good luck in your struggle to exist, and I hope you'll send our greetings to all of our brothers and sisters in Palestine who are struggling right now. And it is clearly an existential crisis and existential struggle in Gaza and in the West Bank right now. And I'm sure we're going to have you back on Arab Talk really soon. Thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you.